2014 drew to a close. She was charged with public mischief, pled guilty, and was sentenced to the 2 months she'd already served in custody. She was deemed such a high flight risk that she was locked up until her extradition flight, and guarded on the flight itself. Ms. Azapardi has a long history of impersonating others, lying, and committing fraud, said Rhonda Macklin during Azapardi's immigration hearing. No resource would be spared to make sure she was returned to Australia, and preferably kept there. Chapter 4. The Rope. Ultimately, anyone can be conned if you have the balls to do it. Simon Lovell. Mervyn Barrett had been working for NACRO, a British charity dedicated to crime reduction, going on 30 years. In 1999, he was made an officer of the Most Excellent Order of the British Empire, OBE, and by 2012 he had decided that perhaps it was time for bigger things. His time at the charity as head of resettlement was slated to end in June, and he needed to think ahead. What about running for police commissioner of his old home county, Lincolnshire, as an independent candidate, one of his young employees suggested. Matthew de Unger Brown told him that his mother was a member of the German aristocracy. Her views were in line with Barrett's, and she would be happy to finance the campaign. All Barrett had to do was say yes. And why not? He'd been thinking about crime reduction for decades. Perhaps now it was time to act. Matthew had joined NACRO as a volunteer in the early days of 2012. He had a legal background, he said, and independent wealth. It was an important cause, and he would be more than happy to dedicate his energy toward its advancement. The young man quickly charmed his office mates, impressing them, Barrett later said, with his skills and intelligence. He was undoubtedly a brilliant and charismatic character. Initially shy about his past, Matthew had, over time, opened up to the older man, perhaps seeing in him a sort of mentor and role model. His father, he told him, was Lord Malcolm Brown. He had served as a senior envoy to Hong Kong. His mother, the Baroness Renate Margaret de Unger, was a Prussian royal. But not all was rosy for little Matthew. He had, he confessed, a dark secret in his past. Maybe it was because his parents had left him so much to his own devices. Maybe it was all the travel. But whatever the root cause, he had, a few years earlier, been in prison. The charge, corporate tax evasion. Matthew's revelation only led to a deepening of his and Barrett's growing trust. And to Barrett, he seemed like a perfect fit for the organization. After all, it was part of the organization's mission to rehabilitate criminals. And Matthew had told him, in confidence, of course, that in prison he'd developed a social conscience and wanted to help others while working out what to do with his life. It seemed right to give him a chance, Barrett said. And so, when his young protege suggested an election campaign, he listened. What convinced him above all, though, wasn't the young man's enthusiasm. He was impressionable, and Barrett was his boss. But a letter Matthew received from his mother, the Prussian royal. In the letter, he later told the Sunday Times, she affirmed her faith in his abilities and even asked him to join the board of the family charity, established to honor Matthew's twin brother, Sebastian, who had, alas, died unseasonably young in a drunk driving accident. It was called, simply, the Sebastian Foundation. Barrett was touched. Not only by the offer, but by the show of trust from a woman so cultured and experienced. Up until that point, I hadn't been convinced by Matthew's arguments, Barrett recalled. But when I saw the faith she had in me, it was the turning point. Matthew was thrilled at Barrett's change in heart, and his entreaties went a step further. He not only thought a bid for commissioner was a brilliant idea, but he persuaded Barrett that he himself would be the perfect man to run the whole thing for him. He'd had substantial election experience, he said, both as a member of the Young Conservatives movement and during his time on American campaign trails. That, coupled with his towering personality and considerable talent for everything he undertook, persuaded Barrett that he'd found just the man for the job. Yes, he told Matthew. He would run, and Matthew would be his right-hand man. The campaign got underway. Matthew was living up to his promise. Polls, pamphlets, even a television spot. He was pulling no punches in his bid to get Barrett into the commissioner's seat. His intelligent, canny handling of the run convinced the would-be commissioner to give him access to his private bank account. Matthew would need a few last-minute funds, understandably. In those instances, his mother wasn't immediately available. They agreed to a spending limit. £10,000 of Barrett's own money, and a total campaign budget of £25,000, the balance supplied by the wealthy aristocratic family who was placing such trust in him. Whatever Matthew was doing, it seemed to be bearing fruit. Proudly, he showed Barrett the numbers from the independent poll he'd commissioned with his mother's money. Barrett's popularity was on the rise. Matthew set the older man up with a respectable social media presence, a spiffy new website, a Twitter account that soon began accruing followers at a steady pace. On the evening of Wednesday, October 24th, 2012, Mervyn Barrett issued a surprising official statement. The whole campaign, he told the press, had been an elaborate ruse on the part of his ill-intentioned campaign manager. He was resigning. After discovering that I have been the victim of a bizarre and hugely embarrassing deception by the person who was acting, and I use the word acting quite deliberately, as my principal advisor and campaign manager. Barrett had learned the truth. The Fund for the New American Century, the think tank where D'Unger Brown had said he had connections, didn't actually exist, according to Andrew Gilligan's subsequent exposé for The Telegraph, nor did Matthew Pack, its Associated Political Action Committee, a committee whose name was linked to Barrett's campaign website. That healthy Twitter following? 16,000 fake followers, an investigation by the Times of London found. The tracking polls D'Unger Brown had presented for Barrett's inspection, the pamphlets he'd handed out to secure more votes, all purely figments of his imagination. They had never existed. Barrett was now poor to the tune of tens of thousands of pounds. According to him, the case is still pending. Brown drained his account of £84,000 and left £16,000 in bills. His reputation in tatters. He had only £4,000 of his life savings left. When he opened his bank statement to see what could have possibly happened, he saw campaign charges, yes, but also rent, donations to charities, direct debits to the treasury, drinks at a bar in the West End. None of them had been authorized by Barrett. To my knowledge, he later said, there has been no funding for my campaign other than from my own bank account to which Matthew had access. I realized I was completely unsuitable for this position, Barrett admitted to the Sunday Times after his resignation from the race. In fact, after what I've let Matthew get away with, I'm not sure I'm suitable for any position of responsibility. He has deceived me on a shocking scale, Barrett went on. How had it happened? Barrett wasn't quite sure. What he did know was that he was swept away by it all. The references, the charisma, the talent. It was the full package. Whenever Barrett asked for clarification on something that seemed off, he would immediately receive a plausible explanation. Over 5 months, the two men had built a bond of friendship and trust, Barrett felt. I feel totally betrayed and very hurt that he used me to perpetuate some kind of Walter Mitty fantasy, he concluded. I also feel very foolish that I fell for his fabrications when I have a track record of sound professional judgment, but I have to accept the reality. In 2003, Eric Knowles, a social psychologist at the University of Arkansas who had been researching persuasion since the 1970s, and Jay Lynn, an organizational and social psychologist at Widener University, posited that all persuasive strategies could be categorized into two types. The first, alpha, was far more frequent, increasing the appeal of something. The second, omega, decreased resistance surrounding something. In the one, you do what you can to make your proposition, whatever it may be, more attractive. You rev up the backstory, why this is such a wonderful opportunity, why you are the perfect person to do it, how much everyone will gain, and the like. In the other, you make a request or offer seem so easy as to be a no-brainer. Why wouldn't I do this? What do I have to lose? They called the juxtaposition the approach avoidance model of persuasion. You can convince me of something by making me want to approach it and decreasing any reasons I might have to avoid it. The rope, then, is the alpha and omega of the confidence game. After finding a victim and lowering his defenses through a bit of fancy emotional footwork, it's time for the actual persuasive pitch. It's Matthew roping Barrett in by convincing him that he's the perfect person for the job, Alpha, and that there's no good reason why he shouldn't do it, Omega. What's the worst that could happen? The put-up identified the mark and mapped out his idiosyncrasies, hopes, and fears. The play caught the mark's attention and baited the hook. The rope makes sure he bites and the hook sinks deep. Else, with a bit of wiggling, the almost sure deal prey swim hastily away. The psychologist Robert Cialdini, one of the leading experts on persuasion, argues that six principles govern most persuasive relationships. Reciprocity, I rub your back, you rub mine. Consistency, I believe the same thing today as I did yesterday. Social validation, doing this will make me belong. Friendship or liking, exactly what it sounds like. Scarcity, quick, there isn't much to go around. And authority, you seem like you know what you're talking about. These are all alpha principles, used to increase persuasive appeal. And while Cialdini's own motives in setting them out are laudable ones, improve leadership, persuade people about important issues, they can, as so often happens, be used in most any direction. Get some combination of his principles, add some resistance-overcoming Omega tactics, and your chances of roping your targeted mark are good, especially if you've done your legwork in the put-up and laid the right groundwork in the play. The result is a number of persuasive techniques that have been in the repertoire of the confidence artist centuries before they were articulated by Cialdini. On a strip of land along Honduras's Black River, spreading over some 8 million acres, about the size of Maryland and Delaware combined, or a bit larger than Wales, lies a small nation whose modest size belies its promise. The land is so fertile it yields 3 maize harvests a year. The water, so pure and refreshing it could quench any thirst. And as if that weren't enough, chunks of gold line the riverbeds. The trees overflow with fruit, and the forest teems with game. The weather is lovely. Warm, welcoming, sunny. Quite the contrast with the rainy darkness and rocky soils of Scotland. The natives are friendly and solicitous, and just happen to have a soft spot for British settlers. It is, in other words, something of a paradise, and it is called Poirier. In October 1822, Gregor MacGregor, a native of Glengyle, Scotland, made a striking announcement. He was, he said, not only a local banker's son, but the cazique, or prince, of the land of Poirier on the shores of South America. The country was rich beyond compare, but what it lacked was willing investors and settlers to develop and leverage its resources to the fullest. At the time, investments in Central and South America were gaining in popularity. From Mexico to Brazil, the financial opportunities seemed endless, and Poirier appeared to be a particularly appealing proposition. It was unclaimed, and Scotland didn't have any colonies of her own. Could this not be a corner of the New World for her own use? MacGregor was a master salesman. The opportunity he presented seemed too good to pass up, and the cost of missing out perilously high. MacGregor published interviews in national papers touting the perks that would come from investing or settling in Poirier. He highlighted the bravery and fortitude that such a gesture would demonstrate. You wouldn't just be smart, you would be a real man. The Scottish Highlanders were known for their hardiness and adventurous spirit, he wrote. Poirier would be the ultimate testing ground, a challenge and gift all in one. He pointed those who needed more convincing to a book on the virtues of the small island nation by the elusive Thomas Strangeways, actually MacGregor himself. His prospectuses entice the public with their masterful promises, their allure of opportunity, their appeal to scarcity, their admonitions not to let this perfect moment pass by. And they were beyond successful. Not only did MacGregor raise £200,000 directly, the bond market value over his life ran to £1.3 million, or about £3.6 billion today, but he convinced 7 ships' worth of eager settlers to make their way across the Atlantic. In September 1822 and January 1823, the first two, the Honduras Packet and the Kennersley Castle, left for the mythical land, carrying some 250 passengers. The mood was high. MacGregor's salesmanship had been unparalleled. But when the settlers arrived just under 2 months later, they found the reality to be a stark departure from the allure of MacGregor's brochures. No ports, no developments, no nothing. It was a wasteland. For Poirier had never existed. It was a figment of MacGregor's fertile mind. He had drawn his investors and colonizers to a desolate part of Honduras, and soon the hardy Scotsmen began dying. The remaining settlers, only 1/3 would survive, were rescued by a passing ship and taken to Belize. The British Navy recalled the remaining 5 ships before they reached their destination. MacGregor escaped to France. If he was at all remorseful, he had a strange way of showing it. Not long after his arrival, he started the Poirier pitch all over again. His initial investment may have evaporated, but his mastery of the art of persuasion was undiminished. In a matter of months, he had a new group of settlers and investors ready to go. France, though, was a bit more stringent than England in its passport requirements. When the government saw a flood of applications to a country no one had heard of, a commission was set to investigate the matter. MacGregor was thrown in jail. After a brief return to Edinburgh, he was forced to flee once more, pursued by the wrath of the original Poirier bondholders. He died in 1845 in Caracas. To this day, the land that was Poirier remains a desolate and undeveloped wilderness, a testament to the power of the rope in able hands. In 1966, Stanford University psychologists Jonathan Freeman and Scott Fraser observed an interesting phenomenon in their experiments. Someone who has already agreed to a small request, like opening the door for you, would become more, not less, likely to agree to a larger request later on. In one study, they asked 150 housewives in Palo Alto, California, if they would sacrifice 2 hours of their time. A research team of 5 or 6 people would come to their homes to classify the household products they used. It was, as anyone would agree, a fairly big ask, invasive and time-consuming both. It didn't seem likely that many people would be willing to comply. Some of the women, however, had already been contacted once before. That time, in a phone call, they'd been asked to spare a few minutes to answer some brief questions about their preferred brands of soap. When Freeman and Fraser looked at the results, they found a striking difference between the willingness of that one group and the rest of the women in the study. Over half of them agreed to the second request, as compared with 1/5 of those who had not had to respond earlier. In other words, once someone does you anything that can be perceived as a favor, picking up a dropped glove, how many con artists love the dropped clothing article, lending you a quarter for the phone, only a quarter. It's an important call. Spending a few minutes on that phone with you in conversation, that person becomes more likely to keep doing even more on your behalf. Freeman and Fraser called it the foot-in-the-door technique. The funny thing is, they later found, the approach worked even if the person doing the requesting the second time around was someone else. Doing a small favor seemed to open the door to being nice, generally speaking. It's one of the reasons that con artists often work in groups. There's the roper, the one who makes the first request, engaging his chosen persuasive strategies of choice. And then there's the inside man, a second member of the group who sweeps in for the kill with the real request, the con that will be played out. You are already in a giving mood, and you become far more likely to succumb than you would have been without the initial prime. It makes sense. We often make judgments about ourselves based on our actions, something psychologist Daryl Bem calls self-perception theory. If we yell at someone, we're rude. But if we open the door for them, we're nice. As nice people, well, we do nice things. That's just who we are. And there are few things we like more than thinking ourselves good. We like proof that we are decent, giving, generous human beings. As Cialdini points out, one of the elements that makes us more vulnerable to persuasion is our desire to maintain a good image of ourselves. If something is framed so as to make us feel like worthy people, we are much more likely to comply with it. We want to behave in a way that's consistent with the image we've created. Consistency here plays a crucial role in the other direction, too. Not just in our evaluation of ourselves, but in our evaluation of the person we're helping. If I've helped you before, you must be worth it. Therefore, I'll help you again. If I've given you a job in my company, I will keep helping you with your redemption and will keep trusting you, and may even give you my campaign to run. You are worthy. Otherwise, I wouldn't have invested my time and resources in you. If I've given you an investment for your new colonizing mission, I will keep providing you with capital and eager settlers, maybe even some ships. You must be worth it. Otherwise, I wouldn't have given you any money to begin with. It's the logic behind many a successful rope, and the logic that has propped up one of the longest-running cons of them all, the Nigerian prince. In the early years of the 20th century, newspapers abounded with ads for almost all manner of things. Medicines, miracle workers, business deals, lucrative investment opportunities, land and gold investments, riches galore. One day, however, a new sort of ad appeared in the pages of several dailies, an appeal from a certain Prince Bill Morrison. The prince was of noble birth and hailed from the far reaches of Nigeria. All he wanted was some American pen pals. So moving was the wording of the ad that the papers had published his mailing address free of charge. Should not the poor prince find some good old American correspondence? He did find them, and aplenty. After a few letters were sent back and forth to his new friends, Prince Morrison made a simple request. Would his American acquaintances send him a mere $4 and an old pair of pants they no longer needed? In exchange for such a small thing, he would send them vast quantities of ivory, diamonds, and emeralds. To him, they were but worthless baubles. Friendship, however, was priceless. The money and pants poured in. But where were the promised jewels? Complaints flooded the post office. Where was the wealth Prince Bill Morrison had promised to send? Suspecting fraud, the authorities ferreted out the wealthy Nigerian. As they soon discovered, his wealth had been a creation of his fertile mind, as was his nobility. He was American, he was anything but wealthy, and he was 14 years old. Though Bill Morrison's age stopped further legal action in its tracks, the undeniable success of his letters had proven the worth of the successfully thrown rope. Americans had just been taken in with the first Nigerian mail-order con, the old-fashioned predecessor of the email phishing scam that is probably sitting in your spam folder this very minute. A quick check of mine reveals a note from Elena. "Hello," it begins in great excitement. "My name is Elena. I looked your profile and have become interested in you." She's from Russia, too, she tells me. "Cheboksary." "Write to me at once on mine email," the lovely young lady concludes. The Nigerian fraud is a classic foot-in-the-door approach. Prince Bill made his way up to his requests for money. First it was just a pen pal. Something so small and touching, even money-conscious newspapers ran his ad for free. Then it was a few letters. Only then was it cash. And pants. The pants I'm at a loss to explain. And look at nice little Elena. She didn't ask me for a single cent. All she wants is for me to reply to her touching note. The foot in the door is also the exact approach Matthew de Unger Brown used with Mervyn Barrett. From the smallest of favors, let me volunteer in your organization, to the largest ask of all, give me access to your bank account. But all accomplished slowly, incrementally, with great patience and finesse. Not unlike the psychics like Sylvia Mitchell, who rope you in with a low-fee reading and proceed to ask for increasingly ludicrous amounts of cash. But niceness isn't the only way to go. Another effective technique that Cialdini first identified in 1975 is the door in the face, a near opposite of the foot in the door. When someone we don't really know asks us for a large favor, or even someone we do know catches us on an off day, and we understandably refuse, we do indeed feel rude, just as Bem would have predicted. But we don't like feeling rude. And so we also feel something else we don't like. Guilty. So what happens when the person we turn down asks us for something else? Something smaller? Something that seems far more reasonable in comparison? We say yes. Guilt assuaged, and con artist's mission accomplished. In fact, Cialdini found, more people agreed to a relatively small request, volunteering to chaperone at the zoo for a few hours, if you think about it, not a small request at all, after they'd rejected a much larger one, volunteering 2 hours a week at a juvenile detention facility over a minimum of 2 years, than if they'd only gotten the smaller request in isolation. Half agreed to it if it came second, while only 16.7% agreed to it on its own. Here, though, a confidence man must operate alone. The technique only worked, Cialdini found, if the same person did the asking both times. If you're nice, you're nice to everyone. If you're guilty, only one person can assuage that guilt, the one who caused it in the first place. The evening had gotten off to a promising start. Tracy Ward, Marchioness of Worcester, surveyed the room. Slight and elegant, the former actress, she had starred in Cat's Eyes, a detective series from the 80s, and in Cluedo as Miss Scarlet, before retiring from the screen, smiled with approval. They were at London's Number 41, an exclusive Mayfair club that had made its home in the Westbury Hotel, and the room had filled up nicely. The chilly weather hadn't prevented a brilliant turnout. All for the best, since it wasn't just any party. Tonight would be the charity auction for the Marchioness's Foundation, Farms Not Factories. The group, dedicated to ethical pig farming, had already drummed up support from an exclusive list. RFK Jr., Sir Paul McCartney, Tom Parker Bowles. And its film series, The Pig Business, was off to a good start. But this evening was important. It would mean fresh funds and fresh endeavors to better the lives of poor signs everywhere. The Marchioness, Lady Worcester, remembers well the moment when the mysterious young man made his appearance, gliding down the stairs in full evening regalia. Tall, with wavy blonde hair, piercing blue eyes, just a hint of a 5 o'clock shadow, a touch of foundation framing a perpetual tan, a whiff of expensive aftershave. He didn't hesitate to seek out the hostess. His name, he told her, was Sebastian von Anhalt, a millionaire from Monaco, who just so happened, he said, to be dating one of her acquaintances. He took her arm. Wouldn't she like to join him at the family compound in Monte Carlo? He laughed often and contagiously. On the spot, he pledged to raise £100,000 for her charity. Tracy Ward wasn't particularly charmed. He came across as a drunken, upper-class twit, the Marchioness later recalled. But the offer of money was welcome all the same. Donations were donations, whomever they came from. The evening wore on. Von Anhalt worked the room, throwing a smile here, a compliment there. Soon it was time for the auction. Up next, Didisham Lady. She stood proud at 9 inches of solid bronze. And she stood long, too, measuring 12 inches from nose to tail. She was, after all, a pig. A statue of a black Berkshire sow by the sculptor Nick Bibby. Von Anhalt signaled his interest. For 4,000 pounds, Didisham Lady was his. At this point, Lady Worcester recalls, Van Aanholt took a folded check from a Canadian bank from his pocket. It was for $18,000, about $10,000 more than the cost of the statue. Take the proceeds from that amount, he told her. Equal parts baffled and embarrassed, Lady Worcester accepted the paper. Normally, a buyer would not be entitled to his winnings until a check clears. In this case, though, Van Aanholt proved too quick. Before anyone could rightly disentangle what was going on, he was out the door and into the cab, the Didisham Lady tucked snugly under his arm. When the check failed to clear, Ward wasn't particularly worried. Van Aanholt had seemed rather a twit true, but a wealthy twit, and his boyfriend was someone she rather liked. She was sorry for the mix-up, she told Van Aanholt. Would he transfer the money directly to the Farm's Nut Factory's account? Certainly he would. When the cash failed to appear, Lady Worcester found herself stymied. None of her calls or texts were returned. Whatever she tried, there was silence. Van Aanholt seemed to have evaporated, and the bronze statue along with him. She turned to their mutual friend. How could she not have thought of it sooner? It was that connection that had acted as an instant guarantee on their first meeting, the ever-friendly glow of the familiar. Sebastian Van who? Her friend was baffled. Yes, he'd met the young man a few times, but he'd broken off contact after he found he wasn't who he claims to be, he told her. The more Lady Worcester inquired, the stranger the situation became. This, it seemed, was not Van Aanholt's first offense. I spoke to more people and found he's actually this talented Mr. Ripley type who just goes around wrecking lives, she told the Sunday Times. The 4,000 pounds was lost, she was afraid, and she felt blindingly gullible. He was completely plausible and utterly brazen, she later said. And it didn't end there. After his failure to pay, the Marchioness involved the police. Every accusation, said Van Aanholt's lawyer, was a brazen lie. He didn't even have the pig. He even told me to check the club's CCTV, she says. They promptly did just that. It clearly shows him going off with the pig. The maitre d' saw him go off with it. Someone else saw him in the taxi with it. The lawyers changed their tune. He had the statue, they now said, but he'd come across it lawfully. Everyone had been paid in full. As of this writing, pig and check both remain at large. Van Aanholt was in fact the same young gentleman we met earlier in the guise of Matthew de Unger Brown. Only now, instead of the foot in the door as his rope of choice, he came with a full-on door in the face. His first approach to Lady Worcester, an unsuccessful attempt at charm that left her thinking him as something other than charming. Her polite demurral of his offer of a visit to Monaco was a cultured way of saying, never. Who would want to spend more than a minute in the twit's company? Followed by a second favor, far more reasonable seeming, of honoring a Canadian check. The request, in the moment, seemed a small one. And, as the Marchioness herself admitted, she was feeling embarrassed. It wasn't usual policy, but, well, maybe this once. In 1986, Santa Clara University psychologist Jerry Berger proposed a persuasion, or roping, if you will, tactic that relied not on a comparison between two separate favors, but on a comparison within the favor itself, the that's-not-all technique. An effective approach, Berger found, is to start with a false baseline, that is, not at all what you're planning to eventually propose, and then, in quick succession, make changes and additions to that starting point that make it seem increasingly attractive. You make an initial bid. How would you like to get in on this land deal in Florida? And before your mark can respond, you turn it into something else. That's not all. You also get a guaranteed return on your initial investment. People who were approached with a that's-not-all story, Berger found, were more likely to buy into it than those who heard the great offer right away. The that's-not-alling, incidentally, can continue for a while. You need not stop at one. That's-not-all is actually a member of a broader set of persuasive tactics, known as disrupt-then-reframe techniques. First, you disrupt someone's understanding of an attempt to influence her, and then you reframe the attempt in a way that makes her more vulnerable to it. Here's how it works. Harvard psychologist Daniel Gilbert proposes that we understand the world in two stages. First, we take it at face value, in order to decipher the sense of what someone is telling us. And then we evaluate it, in order to judge the soundness of what we've just deciphered. Disrupt then reframe attacks the evaluative part of the process. We don't have a chance to give a proper assessment, because each time we try to do so, the situation changes. Consider this illustration. In 1999, Barbara Davis and Eric Knowles, psychologists at the University of Arkansas, went door-to-door selling holiday or note cards. $3 holiday or note cards, that is. Not a bargain 15 years ago, and pricey even today. When the door opened, they greeted the would-be proud owner of a set of cards with one of several pitches. "They are $3," was the simplest. "They are 300 pennies," was the disruptive approach. It takes a second to evaluate and recalculate. Each of those could in turn be followed by either, "It's a bargain," a way of reframing the offer as positive, or, "They're 300 pennies." "That's $3. It's a bargain." The disrupt and reframe. The only time that people bought more cards than the control condition, the simple $3 request, was when their 300 pennies were immediately made into $3 and then immediately remade again into a bargain. Between 65 and 70% of people then went on to buy the cards, as compared with a quarter when the price was named alone. Disrupt then reframe techniques are legitimate sales tactics, but in the hands of con artists, those cards can easily turn into something else. Like the perennial favorite of selling bogus health products that are immediately presented at a multi-month discount and alongside another product that does something equally wonderful and is being thrown in for free. It's a limited time offer, of course. Better get ordering. In 1984, psychologist Joel Brockner pioneered a new approach, one of the street hustler's favorites, the even a penny would help. Similar to the foot in the door, here asking for a little helps you get a lot. But it's not quite the same thing. You're not looking to make two different size requests. Instead, you're looking to exploit something known as the legitimization effect. A request for a tiny amount of money legitimizes you in the eyes of others. If you were a swindler, you'd ask for a lot, wouldn't you? If you'd be happy with only a penny, what kind of a thief are you? It works the same way for organizations. If you're looking for a tiny donation, a dollar or another inconsequential seeming amount, you look like you're working hard for very little. You're not the type of person to go all tricksy on me. Glafira Rosales perpetrated one of the largest art frauds of the 20th century, selling dozens of fake abstract expressionist paintings to unsuspecting buyers over the course of 20 years. Her success lay in targeting the Knoedler Gallery, formerly the oldest art gallery in Manhattan, as her seller. And why did the Knoedler trust her? For many reasons, we'll come to that in a later chapter. But a strong indicator of Rosales' personal integrity in the eyes of Anne Friedman, the gallery's then director, was the fact that Glafira wasn't focused on money. She didn't care how much it sold for, Friedman told me. She was quiet, not at all pushy. She deferred to my judgment. She would be happy, she told Friedman, as long as the art sold fairly. And for that fairness, she trusted Friedman implicitly. The prices, of course, did just what you would expect in the even-a-penny scenario. They increased. By a hell of a lot. The more paintings were sold, the more legitimate the collection and provenance appeared, the more money they brought in, and the more Rosales and the Bergantinos brothers, Rosales's accomplices, were paid. It worked like a textbook charm, but it never would have been possible if the initial starting point hadn't been a humble one. It was a truly expert rope. A closely related approach is Cialdini's lowball technique. This time, you tell your intended victim that what you want is actually quite small, and once he commits to doing it, raise the stakes. A car salesman can give a ballpark, lowball, estimate on a car, Once the buyer is enamored with the actual car he already thinks he's buying, a different model altogether from the one initially quoted, he can raise the price. "Actually, sir, this particular model comes with..." and so forth. Many a person will say yes where they would have originally said no. It only works, however, if you made your initial decision with a good amount of freedom. If you felt at all compelled or pushed, it can backfire. It's the con artist's bait and switch. Bait with one, switch with another. In some ways, one of the oldest cons of all time, the biblical replacement of Rachel with Leah. You have your eye on one model, but... Most persuasive strategies, the con artist's trope, work by promising more. But there are as well those that operate on Cialdini's principle of scarcity. The scarce is inherently valuable by very virtue of its scarcity. There isn't much to go around, so only the very lucky few can have it. The limited edition, the forbidden fruit, the offer only good till midnight, the members only sale, the collector's item. Pose something as unique or rare, and takers will line up where there used to be none. It works for goods. It works for information. It works for most anything. Bernie Madoff didn't take investment from just any old sucker. You had to work your way in. You had to earn his trust. Some people tried for months, even years, to get him to accept their investment. It only increased the allure. And insider trading, of course, is built entirely on scarcity. Scarcity of information. Rudy Kernyawan, perpetrator of one of the master wine frauds of the century, didn't let just anyone buy his wines, and never right away. Wolf Jaeger, a wine collector who has known Kernyawan since the start of his foray into the world of fine wines, told me, over a glass of wine of course, that he'd worked for months to get the charismatic young collector to sell him some of his elusive bottles. Kernyawan had come seemingly out of nowhere. A wealthy young financial type, he'd made quite a splash at wine auction after wine auction, buying up expensive lots, throwing millions after the choicest of bottles. Then the dinners started. Not just any wine dinners. The wines served here were as exclusive as they come. Some bottles not available for sale anywhere, at any price. The company, too, was a rarefied one. A true sampling of the best in the wine world. The finest tasters, the best reputed collectors, the cream of the luxury world and high society. People skirmished and angled for an invitation. A Kernyawan dinner was an affair to remember. It certainly didn't hurt that Rudy himself was an extraordinary taster. Going blind, he could guess most any wine down to the proper vineyard. Old-time collectors were, frankly, stunned. Here was a relative upstart. And somehow he was able to get his hands on bottles they'd been tracking for years. How was it possible? Rudy had a secret, he let it be known. He'd unearthed a new private cellar in France, and the owner was shipping him the bottles directly. They had never left the basement and had been waiting for years for just such a discovery. It wasn't an unprecedented story. New cellars did come to light all the time. Michael Egan, a former wine director for Sotheby's who specializes in tracking and authenticating private collections, told me. He's examined quite a few newcomers himself. Who was to say Rudy hadn't lucked out? Soon, Rudy began to share his wealth. Not just at small dinners. Now he would sell you cases of some of his wines at the right price. He had many, and he wanted others to have the same tasting opportunity. Yet try as he may, Wolf couldn't seem to get his hands on even a single case. I asked for months, practically begged, he recalls. Finally, Rudy relented. Wolf could be one of his exclusive buyers. A few days later, the cases arrived in Wolf's cellar. Wolf buys vast quantities of wine. He can't taste everything, but he makes it a practice to spot test his new acquisitions, to make sure the bottles are in proper condition. He cracked open a crate and took out a Lafitte. It tasted... off. I didn't think it was fake, he says, just bad. Maybe it wasn't stored properly, I don't know. It just tasted wrong. He returned the entire purchase to Rudy, who, without argument, offered him a full refund. In retrospect, Wolf was remarkably prescient. The wines had been fake, and for several years, investigators had been looking into Kernyawan's sources. There had been one event that tipped the scales, an auction in New York, run by Acker Merrill & Condit, an old and renowned wine store and auction house. The auction was scheduled to include a case of particularly rare bottles from Kernyawan's cellars, including several magnums. The only problem, according to the owner of the chateau in question, that particular vintage never came in magnums. They had never bottled any in that size. Against protests, Acker went forward with the sale all the same. Who knows? Records at the time were patchy. Who's to say the magnums weren't bottled elsewhere? Of course, just like Jaeger's wines, these were not miraculous exceptions. And soon the evidence reached a tipping point. Police raided Kernyawan's house. In the basement, they found old labels, fake labels, recipes for various wines and vintages, the whole panoply of paraphernalia needed to manufacture old and rare bottles. It was indeed an exclusive club, fueled by true scarcity. Too bad it was also fake. Kernyawan is now serving his sentence in Southern California. Matthew de Unger Brown, or Sebastian Van Aanholt, if you will, was born Matthew Edward Brown in 1984 in Doncaster, South Yorkshire, the son of a Hong Kong-based telecoms director of legal affairs. When his father died suddenly of a heart attack at 42, Matthew, then 13, moved in with his mother, Jane, a social worker. They lived in a house not far from his school, by all accounts a middle-class life. In 2007, Brown's mother died of a sudden heart attack as well. As a teen, Matthew attended the Oakham School, an expensive second-tier private school in Rutland, where he was both prefect and, at one time, librarian. School, however, didn't particularly suit him. As former classmate Andrew Cummine later recalled, he wasn't very popular. He was strange, always putting on an act. A complex character. He never revealed himself or his feelings, but he loved public speaking. What Cummine recalled most, however, was Matthew's manner. He had his own stationery, his name emblazoned on top. A bit strange for someone of 13. He was, he'd said, the leader of the Young Conservatives, and he always carried around a thick novel. Ask him anything, and he would quickly formulate an articulate response. And yet he was in the bottom sets for most subjects. Somehow, the veneer covered nothing of substance. In 2005, Brown, by that point openly gay, married up in the world. For months after meeting Renate de Unger Bloch, an art restorer 30 years his senior, with a sizable personal fortune derived in part from her own first marriage, he proposed. He moved into her £2 million London townhouse, close to Buckingham Palace. His legitimacy was increasing by the second. In short order, his new wife appointed her dashing young husband to the helm of Ice Home, her art restoration company. He soon proved, however, to once again be more charm than chops. The company's finances unraveled, partly due to incompetence, partly, one suspects, to more willful misdeeds, until by 2008, what had once been multiple millions dissolved into bankruptcy. Brown and de Unger Bloch soon parted ways. The separation, suffice it to say, was not a particularly pleasant one. His parents dead, his wife estranged, Brown took refuge with his aunt, his mother's sister. He proved, however, a bitter disappointment. "He is 100% trouble," his stepfather, Robert Gant, later said. In 2010, Renate de Unger Bloch died unexpectedly, apparently of alcohol poisoning. Her name, however, lived on. Matthew Brown rechristened himself Matthew de Unger Brown and transformed Renate into, by turns, his mother and his secretary. He'd already been Lord Brown of Ardbricken as a teen and a vaunted city worker, but his horizons were about to expand. German prince, English QC, Monaco almost royalty, the boyfriend of CNN anchor Richard Quest, the Honorable Sir Matthew de Unger Brown. The world was his oyster, and he would soon prove himself to be master at all matters of the rope. In their influential 1959 work, The Basis of Social Power, John French and Bertram Raven posited that there were five major bases from which power derives. Reward power, or the belief that someone is able to reward you. Coercive power, or the belief that someone is able to punish you somehow. Legitimate power, or an actual basis of authority. Referent power, or power derived from your affiliation with someone, or desire to be affiliated with them. And expert power, from someone's expertise on a topic. Con artists are after power. Power over you and your future actions. So how do they derive it? From which base does it stem in order for the rope to work its persuasive magic? The grifter will avoid coercion at all costs. That would be unaristocratic, not to mention unartistic. Con artists don't demand, they don't threaten, they don't intimidate. Instead, they use the softer touch, some reward power with a little authority and affiliation mixed in. In one review of the literature on fraud victims, Marx said that they often thought that not only was the person doing the conning legitimate, but the reward he was offering was the real deal as well. That is a fairly typical perception in many a confidence game. You're dealing with someone to be reckoned with, legitimate power, and that someone is in a position to reward you, be it financially or otherwise, reward power. Indeed, in establishing their legitimacy, the victims said, their scammers appealed often and early to trust and authority. The logic is clear. If you know someone is asking for something, you need to know early on who that someone is and why exactly you should listen. We get authority in two ways, by virtue of what we know, authority based on expertise, or by virtue of who we are, authority based on position. The confidence artist will exploit both, but the second is much easier to fake than the first. Indeed, the first, or at least the perception of it, often follows in its wake. When Dr. Clifford Berry, a professor of physics at New York State Maritime College, first read the Time account of Ferdinand Waldo de Mara's escapades, he, like many others, felt his curiosity piqued. I thought about de Mara's case for a long time. He would in turn tell life some 2 years later, for one simple reason. His name wasn't Clifford Berry at all. In de Mara's forays into the professoriate, he glimpsed his own theretofore successful escapades with academic impostering. The oldest of three children, Marvin Harold Hewitt, was born in Philadelphia in 1920. His father, Samuel, was a police sergeant. Marvin dropped out of high school just shy of graduation. He claimed he was bored. Manual labor followed. Freight yards, factories, anywhere that could use a powerful 17-year-old. Rejected from the army, he joined the Signal Corps. Also boring, he declared. Then he saw something that caught his eye. Teaching. Now that, he mused, wouldn't be boring. In short order, he replied to an ad for an eighth-grade teacher opening at a new military school, Camp Hill Military Academy. His resume conveniently forgot to mention his own lack of diploma. Instead, a degree from Temple University had magically appeared in its place. Soon, Marvin Hewitt was standing in front of a class of eager 13-year-olds, teaching math, geography, and history. That spring, the school closed. Perhaps one thinks due to its hiring practices. Hewitt's tenure, however, had been a success. Instructor Hewitt he began, and Instructor Hewitt, this time with actual teaching experience, he remained. It had gone off seamlessly. Why stop at junior high school? Hewitt began to telephone local colleges. Might they be seeking a physics instructor? He soon learned that the Philadelphia College of Pharmacy and Science was indeed in the market for a new faculty member. When department head Robert Jones asked Hewitt for his name, Hewitt promptly provided it. Julius Ashkin. The actual Ashkin was beyond qualified. He had worked at Columbia, Los Alamos, and the Argonne National Laboratory. All Hewitt had to do was borrow the identity. Jones was impressed. Ashkin Nehewitt was hired to teach approximately 300 students calculus, trigonometry, and algebra. Among his other responsibilities, supervising physics laboratory work. There was only one minor hitch. Ashkin Ashkin had also gone on the job market. That fall, he too was slated to begin teaching at the University of Rochester. For a time, the two Ashkins coexisted in peace. Hewitt had written to Columbia and, for a dollar, obtained an academic transcript. He'd followed his textbooks closely, and the students were scoring on par with other professors on their departmental exams. One close call, Hewitt's real father was shot and killed by a car thief. Reporters gathered around his home. Afraid of being caught on camera and exposed, he hid inside and, for several days, played hooky from his classes. The danger passed. The year concluded successfully, but Hewitt felt too close to home. At any moment, exposure could strike him unawares. And so he began to write to colleges farther afield. In due course, he received a reply. Bemidji State Teachers College in Minnesota was hiring. Hewitt promptly sent over Ashkin's transcript. This time he added a personal flourish. He had also worked for a year as a physics consultant to a certain Christie Engineering Company. No such company actually existed, but Hewitt was resourceful. Stationery and a secretarial service, the latter legitimate, quickly followed. By the time the college president, Charles Satgast, inquired as to a reference, Robert Christie, the company head, was ready with a glowing letter. Hewitt packed up his new wife. He'd recently gotten married to a local girl, proud of being the wife of a professor, and moved to Minnesota. He soon had a 16-hour-a-week course load. Analytical and solid geometry, college algebra, physics, he covered them all. But somehow it didn't seem enough. Bemidji was small. It was, well, boring. He wanted a real university, where people of his own intellectual caliber, such as he perceived it to be, would more readily congregate. Once more, Hewitt sent out applications. He soon received an offer from St. Louis University. Finally, he thought, a school worthy of his name. He would make appropriate demands. His teaching load had been too high, leaving him little time for contemplation and discovery. Here, he would teach 10 hours a week. His students had been of too low a caliber. Here, he would teach mostly to graduates. And college algebra? An insult to his intellect. At St. Louis, he would lecture on nuclear physics, statistical mechanics, and tensor analysis. Julius Ashkin had finally found an intellectual home. There were some close calls. He was, after all, using the real name of a real physicist, but Hewitt was resourceful. His Professor Ashkin flourished. Meanwhile, the real Ashkin was successfully publishing from his tenure-track job at the University of Rochester. Hewitt followed his progress carefully, and after each publication he fearfully checked to see whether it would be the key to his undoing. Would anyone notice the disparity in schools and connect the dots? No. This life of stress was too much. Hewitt needed another change. Again, he began the application process. He would stay Ashkin, but he would lower the caliber of his school. Lesser schools, he reasoned, wouldn't follow the literature as closely. The University of Utah was thrilled. For references, they received brilliant recommendations from Columbia, Argonne, and Los Alamos. The real Ashkin was a brilliant man, making a brilliant career. It was easy to find people willing to vouch for him. His recommendations were far from bogus. They were simply for the wrong man. Hewitt's luck held out. The hiring committee never called Rochester. And one school, Columbia, even offered a convenient excuse for any potential red flags. There had actually been two Ashkins enrolled at the university. While Ashkin I toiled away at the lowly rank of assistant professor, Utah made Ashkin II an unprecedented offer, full professorship straight off. And then came the letter. It was addressed to Julius Ashkin, but with a question mark appended to the end. The postmark, Rochester. The sender, Julius Ashkin. Ashkin I was understanding, saying he assumed that Ashkin the imposter was fundamentally a decent man. He was, he wrote, giving him an opportunity to stop the charade of his own accord, without official action. Someone else at Rochester, though,